From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Climate change is a massive problem. And I guess more than anything, that's the main message I want to send here.
That was U.S. President Barack Obama Tuesday at a press conference in Paris as he wrapped up his trip to the COP21 climate summit.
It is a generational problem. It's a problem that, by definition, is just about the hardest thing for any political system to absorb, because the effects are gradual, they're diffuse, people don't feel it immediately, and so there's not a lot of constituency pressure on politicians to do something about it right away. It kind of creeps up on you. You got the problem of the commons, and you know, you got to get everybody doing it, because if just, you know, one nation is helping, but the other nations aren't doing it, then it doesn't do any good. So you have this huge coordination problem and the danger of free riders. So on all these dimensions, it's hard to come up with a tougher problem than climate change or a more consequential problem.
At the summit's opening Monday, President Obama and China's President Xi Jinping were among the group of notables addressing the gathering, with those leaders of the world's two biggest polluters laying out some of their hopes and expectations for the agreement being worked on over the next 10 days. After Monday's speeches ended, the world leaders headed home and the real work on an agreement began, a number of issues were being raised, including how the burdens of carbon reduction would be shared between the developed and developing nations, and if, after more than two decades, the world is really any closer to an agreement. CCTV's Tian Wei addressed some of these questions with Su Wei, China's chief negotiator on climate change and deputy head of Beijing's delegation to the Paris conference.
Mr. Su, as you have listened very carefully to the speech delivered by Chinese President Xi Jinping, he quoted Victor Hugo, of course, a French writer, on the right occasion in Paris. He talked about extreme resources coming from extreme resolutions. How much do you think those resolutions will come true this time at the Paris conference?
It's winter in Paris now, but we feel like in spring. That is because President Xi's speech brings spring to this winter Paris. if winter comes, is spring far away? And I think that's a very important message from President Xi's speech today. And it's not only bring to Paris the necessary resources and resolution, but what is most important, to bring a much confidence and also determination to the negotiations process here in Paris. I'm sure that with the political will and political momentum that created by the participation of the world leaders, I'm sure that the successful Paris outcome is within reach.
But Mr. Su, you know this better than I do. You have been the chief negotiator representing China in the climate change deals for quite some time. Words are words, yet actions could be actions. They are quite different. The leaders have been very talkative and rhetoric in their speeches, but what about the real actions? One question, Mr. Su. Common but differentiated responsibilities between developed economies and the developing economy. This time we see huge difference once again, Mr. Su.
Yes, this is a very important question, that how are we going to translate the words and pledges into actions and deeds, as already said by the Secretary General of the United Nations at the Paris conference. I think one of the very important things to do here in Paris is to how we're going to reflect the differentiation between developed and developing countries. It's very clear that the developed country parties has to take the lead in terms of reducing their excessive emissions of greenhouse gases, and at the same time to provide the real financial support and technology capacity building support to developing countries. And also, on the other hand, developing countries would join the international cooperation efforts and try to take enhanced both mitigation and adaptation actions, and ranging from the energy efficiency and development of non-fossil fuel, and also to further promote their operation cooperations among developing countries themselves. That is South-South cooperation.
Yes, indeed. Mr. Su, you also heard from the Chinese President Xi Jinping's speech. He called on developed economies to keep on contributing to the Green Fund, which the developed economy has long pledged $100 billion every year, and yet we see it has been short of funds from the very beginning. The developed economies, without implementing their promises, how much will that influence the determination and actions coming from developing countries, including China?
I think if the developed countries fail to honor the commitments to mobilize $100 billion per year by 2020, that would create a huge credibility problem in this process, and also that would have negative impacts on the negotiations here. I think really that we have been trying very hard that for developed country parties to honor their commitments under the convention. For the pre-2020 period, they need to mobilize $100 billion per year, and also for the post-2020 period, they also continue to mobilize the necessary financial resources, as pointed by the Secretary General, that $100 billion per year should be used as a starting point.
But Mr. Su, others would argue, for example, during your negotiations with many of your international counterparts, that China, one of the developing countries certainly, and yet it is one of the biggest emitters in the world. So they would say, why don't you do something first and then we will follow suit, Mr. Su?
I think also that has been said by President Xi that we should try to avoid the zero-sum game, and try to, everybody should make their contributions to resolving the common challenge of climate change. And we are, I think China's actions policies is not dependent whether developed countries would honor their commitments or not, but certainly if they could honor their commitments under the convention in terms of mitigation, adaptation, and provision of financial and technology support to developing countries, that really helps the to move the process forward to reach a comprehensive, ambitious, successful, legally binding outcome in Paris.
Those are beautiful adjectives, Mr. Su, you have just outlined. But we earlier was playing some of the footages coming from Beijing and Shanghai, major cities in China. On the one hand, China's CO2 likely to peak by the year 2030, also set by Chinese President Xi Jinping at his speech today. On the other hand, you see huge environmental problems facing China, this time with the fog being the biggest challenge. And today, it's already reaching PM2.5, more than 500 extreme hazards for the health of the people. So how do you think China, as the chief negotiator, when you explain to the international counterparts, China is going to keep its balance? Can China speed up this process, Mr. Su?
I'm sure that China will speed up its efforts to address both air pollution issues as well as the emissions of greenhouse gases. I think that those policies and actions would have co-benefits. On the one hand, to resolving to mitigate the emissions of greenhouse gases, and on the other hand, try to mitigate the local air pollution. I think Chinese government is very much determined to pursue a path of environmental protection and sustainable development.
But Mr. Su, many would wonder, is that too little too late, or too slow too late? Because people are fed up with the bad air, it seems, from time to time in major cities across China. And secondly, people say no matter how much effort is being made this time at the Paris conference, still 2 degrees is not likely to be reached at all.
I think the 2 degrees would sending out a very strong message to the world that world economy that would try to adapt the new challenges and try to set in a low carbon, green low carbon and sustainable development path, and also while also to build the necessary climate resilience in their economies. And I'm sure that the Chinese government would step up its efforts to address those environmental and as well as climate issues.
What do you mean by speeding up? Is there something specific and concrete you can give to us, Mr. Su?
I think it's for China we had been for a long time it's been take these climate issues and environment issues very seriously, and also given the current status of a very heavy air pollution and the very serious environmental problems, in order to provide the a beautiful environment and clean air to the people, we need to step up efforts to do real actions.
Mm. At today's opening of the Paris conference, the Chinese President Xi Jinping, in his speech, also talked about the quality of international governance. He said the climate change summit this time and the conference in Paris could be a mirror reflecting the level of international governance. What do you think is the degree now we have in terms of our sophistication of international governance, particularly on the climate change issue? You know this better than I do, and I met you many times at climate conferences around the world over the past one decade. It seems extremely, extremely difficult. So the question is, Mr. Su, is the international system and the governing system that we have now really fit with the demands of the public? You see the demonstrations around the world for this.
Yes, I think that we also need to enhance actions in order to produce the good outcome. And I think the very wisdom by the president on the global governance, using the climate global climate governance as a mirror, that the message is very clear. All countries in the world need to take actions in order to meet the challenge in accordance with their respective capabilities, their historical responsibilities, and their level of development, and to do their utmost efforts to cooperate, to engage in cooperation to address the common challenge.
Mm. We have seen the world leaders already made their pledge, at least when it comes to degree of determination, but then it has to be followed up by the negotiations, in fact, operated by you and many of your international counterparts. What does the pledges made by the world leaders this time at the opening ceremony for the conference mean for negotiators like you in the negotiation room in the next few days to come, Mr. Su?
I think the political momentum is still there, and I think negotiators would got that message. They would try very hard to narrow down their differences, try to come up with a good solution to the Paris Agreement.
How much compromise can China make? I mean, when I'm asking this question to a negotiator, it's almost impossible to get an answer. But the question is, many are suspecting whether this conference could be a success and what role China would play. Some say it's likely to be 50-50 when it comes to successful rate. And China, even though positive at the very beginning, how much can China do alone while others do not take action? That's a big question mark. Mr. Su, your input here.
Actually, China cannot resolve the global climate issue by itself.
Mm.
But I'm more on the optimistic side than 50-50 chance of success in Paris. I have a full confidence that we're going to produce a very successful outcome in the end. Although it's not easy process, we need to work very hard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah, I know your schedule is like that, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in the next 2 weeks. Before we go, very important question for you. What do you perceive as the biggest challenges when you are participating in the next round, days and nights, negotiations in Paris?
I don't know. It's really, we have very big problem of time constraint, and that's why I'm calling for 24 hours and 7 days a week. Really, it's not easy just simply translate the political will of the leaders into the text of the final agreement. But we would be trying very hard, try to accommodate each other's concerns, uh-huh. and try to come up with the common ground, while that there's still Paris is not the end of the game. It's a new starting point, and we can also try to further continue to be engaged with each other, try to find the necessary solutions to the technical and procedural matters.
A forced resignation in Chicago that could be a harbinger of more to come.
After this weekend, after effectively handling both the protests that followed the release of the McDonald video last week and the arrest of Tashawn's killer, Superintendent McCarthy and I began a discussion on Sunday about the direction of the department and the undeniable fact that the public trust in the leadership of the department has been shaken and eroded. This morning, I formally asked for his resignation.
That was Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel Tuesday, himself the subject of heated criticism, announcing the forced resignation of embattled police superintendent Gary McCarthy in the wake of the arrest of one of his city's officers for the murder of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. Emanuel did not mention Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez, who has also been under fire for her handling of the case. Protesters have also called for her firing. He also refused to answer questions about the possibility of his own resignation, but admitted he is also responsible.
I'm responsible. I don't shirk that responsibility. I have taken certain steps prior to this date. I'm taking steps today. As I told you, this is a work in process in finding a solution. It's not the end of the problem. It's the beginning of the solution towards the problem. So I don't know if I could do it on page 10 and repeat the line to you. I said up front, before you even asked a question, I take responsibility. None of us are above it.
First Deputy Superintendent John Escalante will step in as Chicago's top cop for the time being. Escalante was promoted to second in command in October and had previously served as a district commander. And now some commentary from imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal on the case of Laquan McDonald.
And now, Laquan. With a name like Laquan, we can safely assume his blackness. Of middling height, perhaps 5'2", with a weight of 130 pounds or so. Laquan bounces down a Chicago avenue with typical teenage abandon. He seems more like he's skipping than running, his right hand holding a penknife of some 3 inches or so. One can almost feel the buzz of youthful testosterone rushing through his veins, a subterranean river of strength, assuring him that he is invincible, that he can punch through walls, get hit with a mountain and rise. And then, without warning, a shot rings out, and it spins him like a top, 360 degrees. He falls. An unfamiliar pain grips him, curling him, folding him into a fetal position, cradled by the cold earth. Then, like heartbeats, come death beats of bullets, and 17-year-old Laquan McDonald is no more. He is but the latest black body blasted into oblivion by a white Klansman in blue. His once unknown name joins a chorus of the dead: Tamir Rice, Mike Brown, Donald Dante Ivy, Eric Garner, Oscar Grant, Freddie Gray, and more, victims all of one of the oldest maladies on the American mainland, white fear. A 3-inch blade, legal, by the way, and 16 shots burned into the body of a teenager. For a year, the cameras go dark until a freelance journalist fights and wins a freedom of information suit against the city of Chicago. The camera replays that savage moment of a boy skipping his way into death. There has been an arrest, yes, but don't be surprised if there is also an acquittal. Any city that can make a murder disappear for a year can surely hustle up an acquittal. Only sustained struggle can make a difference. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Legislation moving through the U.S. House and Senate that would retroactively shorten sentences for crack cocaine possession and, its backers claim, substantially roll back mandatory minimum sentences for other crimes is being supported by some human rights groups and criticized by others. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford has more.
The Sentencing Act is supported by the NAACP and the American Civil Liberties Union. However, the National Urban League and Families Against Mandatory Minimums have refused to sign off on the legislation, which actually expands the list of crimes subject to mandatory minimum sentencing, including gun possession and crimes of domestic violence. Julie Stewart is president of Families Against Mandatory Minimums.
I think that some of our concerns are that these bills actually will probably have a disproportionate effect on minority communities. They have created a new class of crime that can trigger what used to be the life sentence, and now it's 25 years. And so more people are going to be swept up in this new class of crime that will be used against them, and then they will be sentenced to 25 years in prison. And that is of great concern to us. It also doesn't address some of the issues around people with PTSD or mental disabilities or domestic abuse survivors, anybody that got involved in their crime because of coercion or, you know, sort of faulty reasoning that was beyond their capacity to deal with. So there is no exception for that. It also focuses resources on the little guys instead of sort of the major kingpins and drug dealers. And we are going to continue to see people who really don't need to be in prison for so long serving sentences that aren't going to change under the way this new law is structured. So there's just lots of issues that we, you know, think need to be addressed that could go farther than we are. I mean, when we can profile some of our cases that we have on our website and we can look at this person and then compare their crime to what the Congress is suggesting and see that they wouldn't benefit from it, not only that it's not retroactive, but even if someone like them was sentenced, you know, after this bill became law, they wouldn't benefit from it. So that's a problem. When we have sympathetic cases, people who don't deserve to be serving 15 years in prison, and they would be even after this bill became law.
We also see the expansion of mandatory minimums to some domestic violence crimes.
Yes, there are. In the Senate version, there are two new mandatory minimums, and that's one of them. I think that it's hard to separate the crime from mandatory minimums. We at FAM oppose all mandatory minimum sentences. We believe judges need to be able to take into account every factor of every crime and determine what the sentence should be, rather than just applying a, you know, cookie-cutter sentence to everybody. And so although domestic violence is horrible, and I obviously, you know, don't condone it, we still want everybody's case to be looked at individually by a judge, and that's not done in this case. In fact, they're adding a mandatory minimum for it.
In an article that you wrote, you called for distinguishing between mere possession of a gun and possession of a gun while committing a crime.
That's correct. A lot of people, especially in, you know, rural and southern states and northern states, have guns. And so if they're selling drugs to someone and the gun is, you know, in the closet behind them, but not in use, they should not be given an additional sentence for that gun. Or the presence of that gun should not disqualify them from benefiting from what is known as the safety valve, where a judge is able to go below the mandatory minimum sentence. But in the way this bill is written, just the presence of a firearm not even being used will disqualify people from some of the benefit that this bill proposes.
There's clear evidence of racial disparities in the application of the law. Not too long ago in Indianapolis, the U.S. attorney promised that he would demand heavy sentences for possession of guns in what the city had designated as high crime areas. And it turned out that those high crime areas included most of the black sections of the city.
Yeah, no, that's right. And even the fact that the U.S. attorney said that sort of flies in the face of the idea that mandatory minimum sentences, when Congress passed them in the 80s, they thought this was going to create, you know, everybody who commits the same crime gets the same sentence. It's mandatory. But in fact, all the discretion is at the prosecutor's office. And so that prosecutor in Indianapolis may take that approach, but a prosecutor in, you know, rural Kentucky where everybody has guns may feel like, you know, I'm not going to do that. So they're creating disparities between the application of the mandatory sentences and, yes, and I mean, 38% of the people in federal prison are African American. That's, you know, three times the actual representation of African Americans in our nation.
And so in terms of these two bills, what would they have to do to make them acceptable to you?
Well, I think exactly what we've said in our statement, you know, they need to, I mean, in the best of all worlds, you know, repeal mandatory minimums, but that's not going to happen. But they certainly need to not subject more people to more mandatory minimums, which is the way we see this going if this bill goes through as it's written. They've got this new sort of crime called serious violent offense, which on its face sounds like, you know, yeah, we want people with serious violent offenses or previous ones to get more time. But the definition is so wobbly and it doesn't hold when you go across state versus federal. So there's going to be lots of litigation around what is a serious violent offense and does that one work as a strike against you if, you know, in your current situation. So it's opening a door to a lot of litigation the way the bill is currently written. We also, you know, would love to see the ability for the judge to consider people who have veterans, for instance, who had ridiculous experiences happen to them overseas and come home and are, you know, disturbed by it in ways that make them make bad choices, which isn't to say it excuses them, but there needs to be a way to address these special needs of people who have, you know, mental illnesses and addictions and the PTSD and things like that, and that is not included in the bill. I just think Congress needs to think more broadly. They need to look at people that are, you know, as individuals, give the judge more powers to make the distinctions between defendants, because not all defendants are alike, not all crimes are alike, and not all sentences should automatically be alike. So they just need to broaden their safety valve, which would allow more people to be considered.
So discretion is the better part of justice.
Yes, it is. And I realize that it can be a two-edged sword, but in today's world, thankfully, the appellate system works really well. So if judges had unfettered discretion and a judge was giving somebody a slap on the wrist for what would be perceived as a, you know, serious offense, the prosecution would appeal. And that judge is very, very likely to be overturned. And, you know, conversely, if a judge gives a sentence that is so very high and disproportionate to other like defendants, then the defendant can appeal. And, you know, the appellate court is likely to overturn it. So there is a check and a balance on our system. We don't need Congress to get involved in it. The judges are perfectly capable of doing that, both at the district level and then at the appellate level.
When Congress got involved in it, that's when we got the mandatory minimums.
Yes, though I think it's important to realize that mandatory minimum sentences are not new in this country. We've had them since the 1790s. And if you look at the history, the list of historical mandatory minimums, they read like the crime du jour. You can see what the public was concerned about, and then Congress responds by creating a stiff mandatory sentence to address it. So in 1790, it was piracy. You know, piracy triggered a life sentence without parole. But, you know, in the 1800s, it was like refusing to hang a telegraph wire on your property got you 6 months in prison. And, you know, so you can just keep seeing that Congress is responding by creating legislation, sentencing legislation, to address what the public is concerned about. The problem is that it doesn't stop the crime and it doesn't stop people from engaging in the activity. Instead, what it does is just create these really long sentences that fill up our prisons, destroy people's lives, and cost taxpayers billions of dollars.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.